Mentored by some of the best minds in entrepreneurship in the world, then you're listening to the right podcast, Ditch Digger CEO. We're going to be interviewing CEOs and founders who will be telling their amazing rags-to-riches stories. These entrepreneurs who dominate the industries they serve will be sharing the secrets to their success. We'll be talking to millionaires and billionaires, many who started with nothing. You're going to be mentored with golden nuggets of shared experiences from my guests, whose time is worth thousands and even tens of thousands of dollars per hour. I started in the paving business right out of high school, and with no college education, mentorship has been my education of choice. I started over 25 companies in the last 20 years, have generated over $1.5 billion in revenues. My guarantee is this: if you listen to Ditch Digger CEO and you want to be more successful, you will become more successful. The secrets of my success and for many of the world's greatest business leaders will be revealed. Let Ditch Digger CEO mentor you.
Hey, welcome to Ditch Digger CEO. Today I'm here with my buddy Chris, and we've got another all-star. We're excited to talk to Abdul Mulberry. Abdul's in an industry we've not talked about as much as we love that in this industry. And I'm really trying to understand more about it nowadays in my life because I'm traveling even more than ever. And boy, he's going to have some fun stuff to talk about. The aviation industry, aerospace industry is so exciting to me. I think many of our guests think of, you know, what's a cool industry that you could be part of, or this would be one of those, wouldn't it, Chris? So yeah. Abdul, welcome to Ditch Digger CEO today. Thanks for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Abdul, we just basically want you to tell your story. We know we know a little bit about your story, but we want you to tell your story of, you know, how you got to where you got and you know, kind of the shared experiences you can share with our guests when it comes to personal experiences to lead a good life, and when it comes to professional experiences, how to build a great business. That's kind of what we're about at Ditch Digger CEO, and you're on, buddy. So if you can start, start talking about, you know, kind of your upbringing, where you got your entrepreneurial spirit and your leadership passion, and we'll go from there.
Sure. Look, I think like many, I was a young kid. Growing up in Los Angeles, I was trying to earn a couple of extra bucks because my family didn't have a lot. So I started cutting grass, you know, had a non-gas powered lawnmower that I would push around the neighborhood. And I can't believe that I would cut people's grass for 50 cents, but I would cut people's grass for 50 cents. I wanted to do a paper route, you know, when I was about 12, and my mother thought I was in Los Angeles. She thought I was going to get kidnapped, so she wouldn't let me do that. So I kept on to that. When I was 15, I got a job. I lied about my age to get a job at the mall, told them I was 16, because I wanted to work. I was a busboy, at a cafe. Did that for a little bit. And then, somebody at one of the department stores asked me if I'd be interested in working in their stock room, which I did. And I worked my way into selling ladies' shoes at some point. And, when I was in high school, I was, by the time I was 16, I was selling sort of the highest, sort of brands, at this particular department store that was known for selling high-end shoes. And I was making about, so this is in the mid 80s, 83, 84. I was making about $20,000-$25,000 a year in commission selling shoes. So
what? Wait. How old were you?
16.
That's amazing.
Yeah. It didn't hurt that, you know, all my friends' mothers came in and, but you know, I became a pretty good salesman. And you know, if you can sell, you know, back in the 80s, I was selling $300, $400, $500 shoes. for a pair. And back then that was a tremendous amount of money. I know now it's not as much. And so left that, went to school. At school, you know, it wasn't something I took as seriously as I probably should have. But you know, I got through it, served in the United States Navy for about 5 years. That was a fantastic experience. And then,
how old were you in the Navy then, Abdul?
21 to 26.
Well, thank you for your service, buddy. That's awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's part of the American dream, right?
Yes, it is.
So then I went to, I got a job working for an aviation company at 26 years old. I found myself in an industry that I never really planned on being in. I always wanted to sort of be on Wall Street. I thought that's where you made the most money. And that's what I sort of geared myself towards. But I was drawn to aviation and worked for a company. I did very well. And I did very well, I think, because of the work ethic. I always had a work ethic.
So Abdul, did you have some experience in the Navy around planes and stuff? Or tell us where the passion came from.
In fact, I did. I was in Patrol Squadron 49. We were an anti-submarine warfare squadron. So I spent those 5 years living and breathing airplanes. And now, that said, you know, I did decide as I was getting out that I was going to get out, and things are different now, but back then you had to go back and get a civilian rating, they stopped doing. So when I got in, the FAA would show up and you could do a check ride, and, they would certify you as a civilian pilot. I didn't unfortunately get that benefit, because the new administration came in, cut the budget, told the FAA they couldn't do that. And I think it was principally because the military was losing flight crews to the airlines. So they said, hey, stop doing it. So my plan was to go to Wall Street. I thought, you know, I had this thing in my head that I wanted to make six figures. I knew I wasn't going to do it in the military for a long, long time. So I was Wall Street bound, and my best friend and I, at the same time applied for the Merrill Lynch training program. I thought I would get in. I didn't, he did. So he went up to New Jersey to their training school, and then went on to be an investment banker. And I went to work for this aviation company. And, you know, I think fundamental difference, between his career path and my career path are perhaps that, I really understood that, you know, I believe in sort of meritocracy, right? You know, you work hard, you get something for it. Mm-hmm. I really worked hard, and, you know, I started, working, I was making even less than I was making in the military at first, which was fine. I had a night job that supplemented my income to allow me to live. And I just realized that there was a tremendous amount of opportunity in the sector. So I started working hard.
What was the name of the company then?
It was called Aviation Systems International. I worked, by the way, originated in Chicago, but moved down to Fort Lauderdale. So I worked for about a week into the job, my boss got fired. And I was a little freaked out, went to my boss and said, his boss, and said, hey, what do I do? He said, just keep your nose down, keep working, stay out of the way, and you'll be fine. So I did. I started to do his work as best as I could while they were looking for a replacement, which they were struggling with. So at one point I just went to the guy and said, hey, do you want me to answer all these requests that he was getting? This particular company was a supplier of parts to airlines around the world. And my particular boss He covered the Middle East and North Africa. So I asked if I could respond to them, and my his boss, who is now my acting boss, said, "Yeah, go ahead. Just don't, you know, don't get out in front of your skis." And I did the best I could there. I made a sale, and my now sort of supervisor came over to me and said, "Hey, good job on this. You think you can get more work out of these guys?" And I said, "I'll try." And I worked them, and I realized that part of the difficulty I had was I was in Florida, and this particular customer was based in India. And I asked my boss if he would give me a key to come to the office at 3 o'clock in the morning so that I could work on their time zone. And he said, "Oh, that's crazy. That's a security risk. We can't do that." I said, "Well, look, I'm a young guy. I'm fine. I'm a military veteran. I'll be fine. Just give me a key. I'll come in here and I'll make it happen." So they gave me a key, and believe it or not, the first night my boss showed up to see if I was actually going to show up. And I got on the phone, and I, back then we used a telex machine, and I got on the telex machine, and I typed to my counterparty, to my customer, that, "Hey, I'm in the office. Do you need anything?" And he immediately called, and we didn't have cell phones back then. This was pre-cell phone.
It's like 1990, 1995.
This is 92. So he said, "Hey, so let me say this. There were cell phones, just not in my category. I was back then. There were thousands of dollars and very expensive to use." So he called me and he said, "What are you doing in the office?" And I said, "Look, I'm here to service your needs. So what do you need? I'm here." And he said, "Well, here's my list for the day. If you could help me with this stuff, you'd really help me out." So I did. It worked. I booked a whole bunch of sales that day, and I started going to work at 3 o'clock in the morning. And when I started to do that, I started to call other customers in the region and say, "Hey, I'm here." And they said, "You know, what are you doing there?" I said, I'm here to serve your needs. So whatever you need." So I started to get more and more work, and I went from a know-nothing kid to the number one salesman in the first year. I had the biggest region. I became the manager of all. So they allowed me to bring in other people to work for me at that point to take over my accounts. I was working from 3 o'clock in the morning till 6 or 7 in the evening. Just humping it, because look, at the end of the day, when my customers went home, we had a lot of processing to do and we had a lot of stuff going on. So, you know, in order to meet the needs, and the customers just weren't used to having an American company there at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
So
Abdul, give us a kind of a feel of the size of the company and, you know, the culture of the company.
At the time, it was a very entrepreneurial company. I learned a lot from the then CEO who's passed on now, but He was a go-getter. He was always, you know, he was just an outside the box thinker, and you know, he was big supporter of mine in terms of, you know, my ability to be successful on the basis of my hard work. He sort of pushed everyone aside and he saw what I was doing and my success, and that, you know, I was working anywhere from, you know, 12 hours on a short day to 18, 20 hours on a long day. But I was printing money because I was paid a commission. So I was, you know, by the time I was in my second year, I was the director of global sales. So the 3 months after that, I became the vice president of sales. So I became the boss of the guy that fired my boss. And in my By 1998, I was the chief operating officer of the company. And we had decided we were going to go make a pitch to a hedge fund in New York that was investing in airlines and aviation and aerospace industries, because .coms just weren't working out at the time. So we went up and made a pitch, and the next morning, the CEO of that fund called me and said, "Hey, we're really interested in working with you." And I said, "That's great. We're interested in working with you." And he said, "That's the thing." He said, "We don't want to work with your company. We want to hire you to come up and work with us and help us with our business." And I said, "Well, what's the driver? What is it that you are interested, you know, related to me?" And they said, "Look, you've gone into those emerging markets. You've opened up doors. You've proven you can do that. You've got a tremendous amount of knowledge in the aviation industry. You know, we didn't have a role, but we're going to make a role for you if you join us." And the downside of that was when they made me that offer, I was making a ton of money where I was working. And, you know, I was a single guy in his 20s. You know, I owned my own house. I was driving a beautiful car. You know, I was like, wow, I got to give all this up and move to New York, and it's for less money. But it was kind of my dream to work up on Wall Street, right? Even though it wasn't actually on Wall Street, but, you know, to work up there and work in that sector and work, you know, surrounded by all these billionaires and Ivy League guys that, you know, I thought I could learn from, you know, I wanted to do it. So, you know, I talked to my girlfriend at the time, and she said, "You know, don't be a hypocrite. You've always dreamt about doing that job. Don't not do it because of the money. You'll make the money. Just mm-hmm. go up there and prove it, and they'll pay you." So I did. And I worked up there for a number
of years. Okay, wait. How big was the company that you were at up to 1998 as far as people, size, revenues, whatever? How big was the street company?
Probably 100 people. And when I left, probably $75 million in revenue. And I went to the second largest hedge fund in the world. So at the time, it was assets under management about $30 billion. But in that, $30 billion today isn't a lot of assets under management. But back then, there was only one bigger. And I was going to work for a very special group within the fund that only invested in aviation and aerospace assets. One of the things that you would know is, you know, we were the equity in JetBlue. So that was one of the big investments that we made back in 2000, we made the investment in JetBlue, and that obviously was one of the most successful ones. But we did everything. We tried a hostile takeover at TWA. We bought maintenance businesses around the world. We started airlines in China and India and in Turkey. You know, these were emerging markets, and you know, it's where they really used my skill set of going out into the market and trying to identify opportunities. So I spent a ton of time in India, ton of time in Turkey, a ton of time in China, way before those countries were what they are today. Today they're powerhouses, but back then, it was a challenge. I mean, you know, China, the first time I went to China in the 90s, there were millions of bicycles on the street. Today you won't see a single one. It's all cars. India was sort of third world impoverished nation, and now it's just this bustling tech empire. And Turkey, I can't even explain how Turkey has grown. It's really becoming the center of the earth in terms of global connectivity. There are more people, in fact, living within a 6-hour flight of Turkey than any other city in the world.
Really?
Yeah. So it is, think about it. It covers the population of Russia. It covers China. It covers India. It covers all of Europe, and part of Africa. So North Africa. So that's why a particular airline, Turkish Airlines, is killing it. They've become essentially the hub to connect from one part of the world to another. So it's incredible. So I did that. I worked there for a couple of years. You know, the the world started to melt down because of the dot com.
What was the name of the hedge fund?
Soros Fund Management, the Quantum Fund.
Soros?
Yeah, George. The guy. The guy people don't like a lot these days. Back then he was a capitalist. Something changed along the ways.
Yeah, I guess. Wow.
Yeah. So while I was there, things started to melt down up in New York in the financial industry. So they asked us if we had any ideas. You know, they weren't investing in equities anymore. They weren't investing in companies because things weren't going well. They said, if there's an idea you have to build, we'd be interested. So I wrote the business plan for what is GA Telesis today. That wasn't the name of it. And my concept was to take advantage of this massive inefficiency around jet engines in the airline industry and exploit it. They told me, it's a good idea. In other times they might do it, but it was too capital intensive. And they gave it back to me and they say, it's a nice piece of work. It's yours. Keep it. You want to go do it yourself one day? Go do it yourself. No.
What year is this then?
That was right in the middle of 2000. So things weren't going well at the fund anymore, mainly because we stopped investing because of the markets, nothing to do with the company. So I decided to leave and raise money and do it. The issue was it was capital intensive. So I needed money. And I started to talk to investors and there was a lot of interest, a lot of excitement. And this thing called 9/11 happened. And sort of right in the middle of, it was just when I was gaining momentum. And things cooled off for, a couple of months, October, November. And I started calling my investors and say, look, this might even be a better opportunity because I'm starting, everyone that's in the industry now has problems. I'm starting with no problems. I'm starting from scratch. This is a good time to start. And they kind of laughed at me. They're like, are you crazy? People are never going to fly again. People are going to be scared to fly. Air travel's dead forever. People are going to go to rail, ships, anything but flying. And I said, well, look, there's no replacement for air travel. And unfortunately, as bad as this situation is, it is not a referendum on flying. So flying is going to continue to happen. So they all walked away. I ran into an old friend of mine that, we actually tried to buy his company when I was, at the fund and, he sold it, became a billionaire selling it. And he said, look, I want to get back in. How do I get back in? He said, come work for me. You can run it. I'll start a company. You can run it. And I was like, well, idea. Sorry.
What kind of business was it, Abdul? What kind of business was it he built and sold?
So he just about anything in aviation, this particular guy built. He is one of the pioneers of the industry. He's passed on a long time now, but his name was George Batchelor. George Batchelor was a pilot in World War II. Came back, and he started trading in the surplus airplanes, that the government had, and then, started an airline called AeroAir flying between Oklahoma and Dallas, built it out from there. He was very involved in the success of airlines like Pan Am and TWA. He was the funding behind Laker Airways. If you remember Laker Airways, back in the day, the airline that took on British Airways.
This guy was a legend, really.
He's a legend. He was. And he started literally the whole South Florida aviation aerospace sector, which is probably at least 500,000 working people are there because of George Batchelor. So, wow. And he owned a lot of Miami cause he was buying up Miami, to deploy his cash you know, his whole life. So, you know, George was very wealthy and wanted to get back in. So I said, look, George, you know, I like you. I've spent a lot of time with you, but you and I are too much alike. We're not going to get along if you're my boss. I said, I got this idea I want to do. If you want to take a look at it, here's the book. I had the, you know, back in those days, you made a 2-inch binder full of all the information related to the industry and your forecasts and the risks and all these analyses. He actually took the book and threw it in the garbage. He's like, you and I know this industry. What are you going to do? And I said, well, George, there's a whole bunch of airplanes in the desert that were parked, especially now post 9/11. All of those airplanes have jet engines on them. And those jet engines are fully operational. They're just in storage. I want to buy those airplanes at a discount. And really my business case made even more sense post 9/11 because all the airplanes were being discounted. And I want to take the jet engines off and create something that I called green time leasing. And green time leasing is, green time is the time remaining, the serviceable time, the usable time on a jet engine. And I wanted to lease that green time on an hourly charge basis to the airline. So if an airline flew an hour, they would pay me $1,000 for the use of that engine, let's say. And there was no risk to the airline. And the amount I was charging them was going to be 10 to 20% below the maintenance cost of the engine. So I was going to save the airline a ton of money, and they were going to get engines at a cost that was below their own cost. So George said, I'm in, let's start tomorrow. You know, he was an optimist. It took a long time to document, but you know, by April of 2002, we had our first operation, our building. I hired six people. I hired a CFO. I didn't have any money, but I knew I was going to. I hired a COO. I didn't have any operations yet, but I knew I was going to. I hired a chief commercial officer. I didn't have any commercial agreements yet, but I knew I was going to. I hired a head of IT. And I hired a head of like a director of operations, someone to actually do the work, because there's a lot of chiefs, no Indians. In those early days, I could say everyone I hired was a ditch digger, right? Even my, you know, we used to call our CFO our chief forklift officer, because he would literally, we didn't have an insurance at that point. And the only one that could drive the forklift was an officer that couldn't sue the company. So, we had jet engines coming in, and these jet engines weigh 15,000-20,000 pounds with probably 30,000 pounds of total weight. And, you know, my CFO was driving the engines from one entrance to the other, you know, getting them on the trucks, doing what we needed to do, to get things going. And, you know, in our first year, so we started in April. In our first year, we did, roughly $7.5 million in revenue, and we were almost profitable from day one, because we got the engines working right away. The second year we did 20, the third year we did 40. So 2005, 2006, we did, about $80 million in revenue. We were just doing great. And I gotta say, you know, and a testament to my team, we did this through the worst time in commercial aviation, right?
Yeah.
And so my customers, US Airways, Delta, Northwest, Continental, all filed bankruptcy while having my engines on wing. And that's not a good thing. But luckily, I was able to get them back and put them somewhere else. So, you know, I got them into European airlines. I got them all over the world. I had a point where I had hundreds and hundreds of engines in operation. I was just charging an hourly rate. So the airlines loved the business. The industry, you know what happens when you're successful? The industry starts to look at it and go, oh, we should do that too. So some competition came in the market, and that was fine. And in end of 2006, a big private equity firm called and said, hey, you know, we're interested in your company. We've got some plans, you know, can we fly down and see you? And I remember the founder of that particular fund, who's a pretty famous guy these days, I won't say his name, flew down in his brand new G4 SP, and, you know, and made me an offer. You know, he just based on market intel, he's like, I know what your company's worth. And he said, this is what I'd like to offer you. I was like, holy moly, that's more money than I could ever imagine. He said, what do you think? I'm going to pay you in stock. You got to keep the stock 18 months. After the 18 months, you can sell it. I was like, look, I agree with you on the valuation. I said, you know, I worked up in New York. I know how to value a company. Your number's right. It's justifiable. I want to accept it, but I need an advisor. I don't have the experience in taking stock. So I want to get some more information. So I flew up to New York and I started interviewing investment banks. So I went to Lazard, I went to JP Morgan, I went to Morgan Stanley, I went to Merrill. And all of them said, yeah, we're interested, especially because of who was buying. They didn't really care about me. I wasn't a big deal. At $80 million, it was a rounding error. But the guy buying it, he was a billionaire and a top guy on Wall Street. So, and he had a plan for my business to merge it with another one of his businesses. And so I ended up down selecting to two. It was going to either be Lazard or Merrill. And we were in New York City. This was the day that JetBlue's route network melted down because of the massive snowstorms all over the nation. And I remember we had to walk through, you know, a foot of snow on Park Avenue to get to our meetings. And when I got to the Merrill meeting downtown, they said, hey, we've decided that we're not going to represent you. And I said, you know, why not? They said, because we'd like to make an offer ourselves. And I said, well, look, I really don't have the time. I don't want to upset this guy. He's worked, you know, he's got me an offer. He put it in writing. You know, they said, give us 24 hours. We just got to get approval. So 24 hours later, they gave me a $20 million higher valuation, cash, and for 49% of the company. They didn't want to own it. They just wanted to be part of it. And for me, and their argument was, look, you got a lot of runway. And with our capital, and this is pre-world financial crisis, and with our capital, you can do great things. So we'll give you enough money to retire. The rest of it, you know, we'll build together. And then you got another bite at the apple. So I said, all right, I like the offer. I accepted their offer. It took us about 6 months to close. And here's a tidbit and something that I learned that day. So I'm at the World Financial Center, which is where their offices were. I'm standing in the conference room. I just signed 1,000 documents, it felt like, that were sprawled across this 30-foot conference table. And we were waiting now. They said they're going to order the wire transfer to my account. And they'd come back and let me know when the wire went through. And I was looking out the window, you know, really across the Hudson, the West River. And I was thinking to myself, I've done it. I'm done. Like, this is it. Like, if I don't get another penny in my life, I'm good. Like, I don't care. If it doesn't work out, because I'm good. And then I thought to myself, I was like, but I don't really have anything to buy. Like, I what am I going to do if I stop work? I was literally 40 years old. Like, what am I going to do? So.
Well, think about those 14 years before, you just want to find that job and make six figures. Remember?
Yeah. Right. Well, it gets better. So, So, you know, I thought to myself, okay, I should be happier because I've achieved every bit of success I thought I was going to achieve. And it was at that point I realized, you know, success isn't a number. It, you know, I thought it was to that point. Like I thought having enough money where I could buy everything, anything I wanted or retire at any time I wanted was when I'd be happy and felt fulfilled, but it wasn't. And it's really then, and I tell this to my kids all the time, success isn't a number. Success is when you'll know it when you achieve success. And I know it for me. Success is success is when you do things without money playing a role in the happiness of you achieving whatever you did. So that's where I am today. But back then, you know, I didn't feel at all happy that I had just sold half my company to Merrill Lynch. But, you know, I looked back and I had a smile on my face and the COO of Merrill Lynch at the time, he looked at me, he's like, happy day for you. I was like, yeah, it's a happy day for me. He's like, yeah, you're going to have a lot of money. He said, I hope you're going to let Merrill Lynch manage that money for you. I was like, oh, maybe we can talk about it. You know, haven't thought about that yet. He's like, well, what's the smirk on your face? It's like, well, you know, there's something, but I don't want to tell you yet. And he's like, well, when are you going to tell me? I said, as soon as the money's in my account. He's like, is there something I got to worry about? I said, oh, no, it's irony. He's like, okay, I can wait on irony. So 2 minutes later, they came in. They said, hey, the wire went through. Check your account. And I had one of those old big Blackberries at the time. And I called my bank and I put my account number in. And, you know, there was, you know, it was just the whole process. And I listened and I was like, holy shit, you know, I got the money. And I said, yeah, I got the money. Thank you. He shook my hand. He's like, now tell me, what's the smirk about? I said, well, you know, about 14, 15 years ago, you guys turned me down for the Merrill Lynch training program. And here you are buying my company. And he said, really? I said, yeah, really. He said, why'd we turn you down? I was like, I don't know. He turned me down. He said, no. So here you are buying the company. So you could have gotten me a lot cheaper if you would have hired me, you know, when I was young. So, you know, in a nutshell, you know, that was that iteration of the company. You know, a year later, unfortunately, Merrill Lynch was bankrupt, along with everyone else on Wall Street. Luckily, they were one of the banks selected for a bailout in a merger with Bank of America. And Bank of America, from the time Merrill Lynch acquired half the company in 2007, December of 2008, we were now Bank of America was my shareholder. And they stayed a shareholder for 11 years and exited with a massive multiple. Good for them. They were great partners. They helped me institutionalize my company. And helped me through rough patches. You look, the world financial crisis was tough, but we grew, and we continued to grow and diversify our business. And the sort of Bank of America Merrill Lynch team really helped us to structure the company in a way that made us interesting to other parties. In 2012. We were approached actually by Merrill Lynch Japan saying, hey, there's a Japanese investment firm that's interested in your company. They'd like to acquire it. And at the time, Merrill Lynch or Bank of America Merrill Lynch said, yeah, you know what? We're ready. Under the new rules, we probably shouldn't own this business anyway. So we should exit. So this company at the time, it was called Century Tokyo. And we met with them and they said, we like your business. We'd like to buy it. We said, all right. We worked with them. They said, we'll come back in August of this year and make you a formal offer. So they came in, they brought their president, which is very rare for a Japanese company to send their president. And he and I hit it off right away. He was just a fantastic guy. And he said, look, I got bad news. We can't buy your company. It's too complex. We thought it was a lot more straightforward, but there's just so many different things you do that we didn't know. But we would like to buy 20% of your company. And I said, you know, thank you. But I don't want a 20% Japanese shareholder. It's just, it's too complex. I'm okay as I am. And I've got a great shareholder today. We're good. He's like, well, you haven't heard the price. And I said, okay. So, so he made an offer. We asked to break, because I certainly didn't want to show my hand, but it was a very healthy number. And my board members from Bank of America at the time said, you can't say no to them. And I said, I know. They're just, we can't. So we both diluted 10%, an additional 10%. And they came in for, a 20% piece of the company. So now the shareholders were myself. In 2007, I had, given equity to, my management team. So all of them were now small non-voting shareholders, but they all had a piece of the company. In 2018, the bank regulators went to Bank of America and said, hey, you can't own this anymore, or you have to consolidate it. You either got to buy the whole thing or exit the whole thing. They came to us and said, what do you want to do? And we said, look, you know, we love you guys, but we don't want to be Bank of America. You know, it'll be too tough to do what we do. So they said, all right, find a buyer. Let's put the company up for sale. At the time, the company was doing really well. So this is 2018. We're probably a $400 million company. Doing very well. And Century Tokyo by that time had changed their name to Tokyo Century. I don't know why. they changed it, and Tokyo Century said, we'll take it. We'll buy it. But then we would then go from being a U.S. financial institution to a Japanese one. And we said, yeah, sure. Without either. So they bought up to 49%, and then we sold 10% to All Nippon Airways, which is, you know, one of the best airlines in Japan, top two. And they did it as a strategic investment because they did a whole bunch of stuff outside of the airlines. They Nippon rental car, hotels, flight training businesses. So they came in for 10%. That transaction closed in 2018. By 2019, the company had record results. We had our biggest year, our biggest, profit in the history of the company. Things we were just smoking it, and it was just fantastic. First quarter of 2020, we had our biggest quarter, in the history of the company. And in March of that year, as you well know, this thing called the pandemic started. We didn't know it was the pandemic. We had this thing, this flu-like thing called, but they hadn't even named COVID at the time, that was taking over the world. By May of that year, we were in trouble. Our revenues were down 90%. It was horrific. We were lucky, because we had come off a fantastic 2019. We were cash rich. Our team was, we all always operate lean, and I got another sort of tidbit for you there on that, but, we always operate our company as if we're filing bankruptcy tomorrow. We don't, you know, we look at it and say it could all end. So in the history of the company, we've never laid off a single employee, no matter what happened. And here I was faced with 90% reduction in revenue, and I had to tell my board something. I had shareholders, you know, this wasn't just my company. I had to go to them and say something.
So you were at a high, let's say 2019, half a billion or so, or
a little more than,
Now you're down. Now you're down on course to being a $40-50 million company.
Yep. Well, luckily we did that in the first quarter, so we're going to be bigger. It was going to get bad, and we're printing losses, right? So even revenue didn't matter. We were going to print losses. So, I went to my board and said, look, company, we have a lot of assets, but we sold a lot of our assets in 2019 because the market was robust. That's why we have all this cash. So we don't have a lot of problems, but if we get rid of our people, we're going to have a lot of problems.
Yeah.
So what we proposed to them was like, look, for the foreseeable future, and this is May of 2020, I would like to commit to my team that through the end of the year, they all have a job. And we'll reassess in December and decide if we can keep doing this. But my only caveat is that we're going to have to cut back in every other area to be able to make this happen. And we also, look, we have banking agreements and all kinds, we don't want to go in default of those either. So we went to our employees. We had like a global town hall. And, at the time, I think we had about 600 employees. And I just said, look, I've gone to the board. They've agreed. We're not going to lay any of you off. All of your jobs are safe. You will receive your 2019 bonuses because we had held those back because we were wondering, because you were in that in 2019, so you'll get paid for that. And if we could sneak off a profit this year, even if it's a couple bucks, it's going to keep the track record of the company of being profitable since its inception. And I said, look, but here's the deal. This is not the time to suck. Like, if you suck, we're going to terminate you for sucking, not because we're laying you off. So
yeah,
just here's our deal. We're in Florida. Everyone comes to work every single day. I'm coming to work. Every leader of this company is coming to work. You're going to come to work. We're going to support the airlines that are flying. And for those in other countries, and I had offices in other countries, we'll do as much as we can about going to the office as we can, but we have international laws that, for instance, the UK had a mandatory work from home. I couldn't do anything there, but we had a system where they checked in and we knew they were working from home. We have a big jet engine overhaul operation in Helsinki, Finland. You can't repair jet engines from home. They had to go to work every single day to repair jet engines. And what we realized very quickly was the world was changing. It was becoming a sector where the shift went from passengers to cargo. All the passenger airplanes were being converted to these impromptu cargo airplanes flying packages because everybody was ordering everything for delivery at home because they were home. So next thing you know, our biggest customers are FedEx, UPS, Amazon, DHL, and every other cargo airline around the world. And guess who the only guys are that are working? Us. And next thing you know, the business picks right back up and we ended up that year profitable. And
wow.
2021.
So basically think about this, Edward. We talk about pivoting often in business. Like over my 43 years, we pivoted a few times to survive. And when we've done it, it's always given us the ability to maybe, serve our customers with a new idea, a new product, a new service, because we had to pivot into something to survive, right? Man, this is the cool pivot, because usually when you pivot, you probably lay some people off. You probably got to get leaner. In your case, you basically took the whole, 600 employees, teammates there, and you did a massive pivot to say, okay, guys, we're committing to the end of the year, that's not common, number one, okay? We're committing to you guys to the end of the year. And with that, we've got to think outside the box. We've got to pivot. We have to do whatever it takes to make sure that we turn a profit. And so with that, you guys discovered, number one, you're probably the only ones that didn't cut back. So your service to your customers were better than ever, probably, right?
Yeah, they were. It was our year-on-year business with those customers doubled, tripled. They came to us for everything. And then when the airlines like Delta, United, American, that were passenger airlines, started calling us, like, oh, you guys are there. You guys are actually there. We can get the part today. We can get the service today. Yeah.
Wow.
Today. And, you know, we didn't lose a single member of our team, other than those that sucked. And we had a couple that did. You know, a couple said, look, the world's working from home. I want to work from home, or I'm not working for you. We're like, all right, cool. You know, that's your choice. Go work for someone else from home. We're working at the office. And the team stuck together. 21 was a good recovery year. We probably got to half of 2019's profit. And you remember 2019 was a record year. 2022 beat 2019. And in 2023, we doubled the net income of our highest ever year. So the company is moved in the right direction. And I gotta be honest, a lot of it has to do with that decision to keep the band together, to keep us all together and to continue working. So while, you know, when the pandemic ended, everyone started to rebuild their teams. I didn't have to rebuild anything. I just picked up market share and I continued to grow my business. And this year, in 2024, our target is to triple our 2019 net income. So, and we're on track to do so. And
how awesome is that? You know, and similar to that, though, we had tough years, where new construction went by the wayside, right? There's very, in our industry, cyclical, construction, you know, which is happens every 4, 5, 10 years, is common. And so we had to pivot to building owners and property managers to do work for them. And eventually we realized that, you know, why do we want to be in the world of the cyclical new construction world, right? And we totally pivoted out of it. And it was the best thing we ever did because we, you know, that at the time we pivoted, we were probably $7 or $8 million, maybe $10 million company. And, you know, today of the few hundred million we do in revenues, 98% of it is maintenance work. It's repaving parking lots that we discovered back then was the best way to be bulletproof, right? Kind of recession proof. It's just like the same thing as you. Now I really admire the fact that, you know, you're rewarded for being loyal to your team. And because most people, especially when you have all the outside board members, you know, as well as outside investors, most of them are going to continue to, and they probably did pressure you to say, are you sure? You know, let's lay off, you know, 300 of these people at least, and this is going to drop to the bottom line. This big number is going to drop to the bottom line, right? And so with the white.
I'll say this, my shareholders, they did say, are you sure? Definitely asked the question, but after I said, yes, I am sure that this is the right decision. They supported me the entire way. And really, you know, from their perspective, being based in Japan, you know, they weren't allowed to go to work. You know, they had to work from home. They had all kinds of restrictions. You know, I think they appreciated what we were doing and that we were coming to work. And look, I know plenty of companies that said, hey, we're going to go in the office, but you know, the managers stayed home and said, well, we don't need to be in the office. We're the managers. We could just tell the workers what to do. But you know, to your ditch digger philosophy, if you're not in the trenches, digging those ditches with the people side by side, helping them, you're never going to be successful. Organizationally, those people, if you don't show them that you're just as committed as you expect them to be, you're never going to succeed. And you're never going to build a team that you can count on when you need them. And look, I think for some people it's a hard decision where, you know, they're looking at the rest of the world and say, everyone else is working from home and my employer is telling me I got to come to work. There's something wrong with that. And we said, look, this is a choice. If you want to work here, you come to work and we'll give you all the social distancing and all the health parameters you need to protect yourself. But if you don't want to do it, it's okay. You can file unemployment. The government's got all kinds of programs to supplement your income. We're not going to contest it. We'll even terminate you so you can get unemployment. We're not going to stand in your way.
So what you're saying, so you know, what you said is important, right? I mean, in all, you know, you grew up in this industry from the bottom up, you know, selling a, you know, one customer at a time, and then, you know, being out, have the opportunity to start up this awesome organization to understand every nook and cranny of it, right? So you were in the trenches, you were a ditch digger from the beginning, but then people that were ditchdiggers originally become CEOs and wealthy, right? Not always do they have the the work ethic, the mindset to go back in the ditch and work next to everybody again, right? It's one thing that your team knows you can do it, and that's really cool. But in tough times, when you actually go back and do it again, I think then you build a camaraderie with your team that's irreplaceable in the future, right?
Absolutely.
And so I believe that, our team in the toughest times, I can look at my team members that stuck with me in some really tough times, and they're leaders of my business today that understand we have grit and we're going to get through tough times because we understand how the ditches are dug and how we have to go back and work alongside and continue to dig ditches in tough times. Then it's a matter of understanding when to get out of the weeds, which of course you've done a great job in getting back out of the weeds and focusing on that vision as you got this opportunity for growth again. So that's what leadership's about. When you think about your location to be in Florida also, and I was in Illinois, and we still, I had a golf course I told you about. I got a great golf course. All the golf courses were shut down for like 45 days, except mine. I told Pritzker, our governor, there's no way, we're not shutting down. This is a private golf club. My members are my partners. They pay to golf this golf course. They can come and play anytime. There's no better place to social distance than on a 250 acre golf course. Right. And so the police tried to shut us down. We had all kinds of things that they're going against us, but we never shut down. Our members appreciated it. We gained more members. And we actually gain members that understand the value of freedom. So it's kind of cool. But in the toughest times, I think we have the opportunity to shine more than ever if we just work with our team to say, hey, we got problems. Help, let's come together and solve them together. And when you do that, I think the best opportunities come about. You solve the biggest problems for your team and your customers, and you become a lot stronger. So yeah. I love what you've done. Okay, so what are your revenues projected to be in this, this year?
Right around $900
million. Wow. So, you someday wanted that six-figure job only, was that 25 years ago, 30 years, whatever it was, right? You were looking for that six-figure job. And now you got this, how many figure business now are we talking?
I guess that's nine. Hopefully, look, if things go well, we can hit 10. But we're comfortable with nine figures, 900 million ish revenue, hit the billion mark next year, which will be another milestone for the company. We're very excited about it. The trajectory is in that direction, so there's nothing holding us back.
You're still a young dude too, man. You're still a young guy. You've got a lot of
56 years old. I feel young because I'm still, as Chris can attest. I was up at 5 o'clock this morning and I spoke with him. I still get up at 5 o'clock every morning. I'm a six hour sleeper or less. That's all I need. I feel fully charged, after 6 hours. And I'm ready for every day. It's not a grind, and that's another thing I'll say, if you got a business or a job and it's a grind, let me give you a quote. When I actually went to Kellogg, up in Evanston, I gave the graduation speech and I met a lot of people that were sort of, entrepreneurs in waiting. They all wanted to do something. They all talked about it during the years that we were together in school. I want to do this. I want to do that. I want to start this or start that. And, I just said to them, in that speech, I ended it with the following statement. It was, stop doing what you do to survive and start doing what you can do to thrive. And, for any entrepreneur, for any business owner or future business owner, there is a point where you have to make a decision. If survival is the most important thing to you, then you should just keep doing what you're doing. But if you truly want to take yourself to the next level, you have to stop doing what's easy survival's easy. I mean, really, it is. It's not hard, right? You just get a job and you live within your means and you'll survive. That's easy. But if you want to thrive, if you truly want to thrive, you want to be successful, if you want something bigger than your imagination can conjure up, then you have to stop doing what you do to survive and start doing what you have to do to thrive. And what gave me personally, what gave me the sort of ability to do it was the support of my wife, who said, you know, when I said to her, she didn't say that's a quote I made up many years later, but she didn't say, she said, look, we're young. We'll be fine. You want to go off and do this with George? Let's do it. This is the time to do it. And this is a time I just bought a house, just had a kid. You know, we didn't have two nickels to rub together. You know, we had a little bit, but not a lot. So we were okay. You know, we could live without a paycheck for a little while, but not a long time. And yeah. She said, look, let's do it now. Let's go for it. And we did. And this is the benefit, right? We're thriving. And that is the one thing that I find with a lot of folks that are either thinking about doing it or will never do it is because they're always thinking of their survival. I got to make a mortgage payment. I got to take care of my kids. I got to do this. Well, you can do all that in an entrepreneurial environment. You can do all that.
Absolutely.
On your own. You just got to be willing to do the work. I remember my wife had a friend that said to me once, she said, hey, can I talk to your husband? I start a business. I'm struggling. And I said, sure, I'll talk to her. So I talked to her. She's like, look, you know, I get to work, you know, I'm there at 9 or 10 in the morning. I'm done at 6 o'clock. You know, like, where did you find the day to do marketing and keep your books and look at everything? It's like 9 to 6. It's like, that's half the day. What are you doing in the other half of the day? If you want to own a business, it's 24/7. Like, you can't stop thinking about it. You don't get to turn off when you get home. You've got people counting on you, whether it's your family or your employees, people are counting on you. So
Absolutely. You
go home and you might shut off to have dinner. You might want to watch an episode of something on Netflix. And then you go right back into what do I need to do tomorrow to make sure everything keeps going? And you go to sleep thinking about it. And when you wake up, it's your first thought. Today, my first thought was I got to call Chris. But normally I'm thinking, what do I got to do in my day?
How awesome was that? You know, and the cool thing is, you know, I believe that when you have the energy you have, because you're so passionate about this awesome industry you're in and serving your customers, I believe that energy happens when we love serving others. And man, you served others in tough times, other people weren't serving them, and you're still serving them today and figuring out how you can differentiate and serve them tomorrow, right? That, in my opinion, is a difference maker. And the energy you and I believe that we get when we serve people at a world-class level and we know they're happy, right? Feels really good. And when you have a team of many people that are your teammates, right? That you basically report to, right? When they need you, you better be there for them. And when you're there for them, helping them solve problems, that's energy that you just can't get anywhere else, right? I'm not a drinker. I'm not a partier team. I like having a good time, but I'm not much of a partier. But because I love the energy that I'm able to generate myself and out of other people too. I was with a guy this last night for dinner, Newt Gingrich, who lives over here.
Sure.
So Julie and I went to dinner with him last night, and what an amazing guy. This guy at his age has energy like, you know, like a young person does, because he understands the past. He's a historian. He's been a part of major stuff in our country's history. And he's looking 20, 30 years forward about what's going to happen or what should be. And he's just got energy that, you know, till 11:30 last night. We started dinner, I think, at maybe 7. So, I mean, we were with him for a long time. And he had as much energy at 11:30 as he did at 7. Okay. Why? Because he's passionate about the things his wisdom allows him to be very, very, very strong at, right? Just like you are.
Absolutely.
And so,
great. And I love the man. I actually do know him. So I think he's a great guy and a brilliant political mind.
And Calista also, what a sharp woman she is, and the history that she's in touch with, and she's an amazing person as well. So we just got a kick out of it. I guess it's probably the third time I've been around, you know, been with him for any length of time. But he's just so generous with his time. He wrote down probably three different things that we talked about that I had as ideas for the country and for you know, roads and bridges and things I know about. And he wrote him down and said, would you want to do an article on that? Let's do an article on that together. Hey, Gary, I want to get you in front of, you know, this person or that person. He's still putting people together, right? And so what a cool guy. But again, what do we learn from that as Newt and his age? He's still looking 20 years forward. He's energetic as can be, passionate about the subject matter. He's been so strong in. And if we can continue to be that the rest of our lives, we're going to be, you know, we're going to be inspiring other people on our teams, off, you know, friends of ours, hopefully to be way better than they would be without us, right? I think that's what God wants of us. That's the fun of life. And we know that with a little bit of wisdom and shared experiences, we can maybe help somebody else out, right?
Right.
So,
right.
Really cool. Okay, Chris, what an amazing person, leader we have here today, and how fun was it to listen to his story, which is incredible. I mean, I could talk to you for all day long, actually. And I'd love to get you on again, maybe to talk about some other things.
Yeah, I'd love to. And let's spend 4 hours together on a golf course here or there or in Chicago. I'm in.
Okay, I'm going to get your cell phone after that if I can. And let's get together down here or up there, either way. Chris, what'd you pick up here, buddy?
Oh, man. Abdul, your story is absolutely incredible and super inspiring. And the way you tell it had me hanging on every word, man. Like, we've been here for an hour and a half or longer. And I'm just like, oh, my, where did the time go? This is awesome, man. Thank you for sharing your time. I have, you know, 5 or 10 questions I would love to ask you, but I want to respect your time. So I'm going to choose between these two. It seems like every big company in the world, all you hear about them is, like, you know, times get rough, layoffs. Google's laying off, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of people. Tesla's laying off hundreds or thousands of people. How did you know that it was more advantageous and a lower risk to keep the band together during tough times than just doing what even, you know, the trillion-dollar companies are doing?
So goes back to early days. So early days, I asked my CFO, I said, look, I want to grow the company. How do I know when I have the money, when I can afford to do that? And he said, well, look, you know, we generate about $1 million per person. Each person on average generates this much gross revenue gross revenue and gross profit. So, you know, if we stick to a formula of every time we have $1 million of revenue, you can hire somebody, we should be okay. No matter what the salary is, low salary, high salary, on average, it works out. So, I've always stuck to, sorry, believe it or not, even though it actually makes no sense today, the size we are, we roughly have 850 employees and we'll do about 900 million. So we're still on that trend. Wow. So, I still think about that, you know, when we hire people and say, you know, if we look at the math in terms of the open positions we have advertised, we'll do about 900 million revenue with 900 employees. So that's our formula. Now, what I've always found is that, I'm only one person. I can only do what I can do. I only have so many hours in my day, and I might work or have the output of more than one person because I'm 24/7. It's not about me. And this isn't about servant leadership at all. Cause I'm not sure I buy that either. This is about, I know the value that my team brings to the organization. They are more valuable than anything else. And I'll tell you what. So I lease aircraft and I lease jet engines to airlines around the world. It's one of my 5 businesses within GA Telesis. And during the pandemic, guess what stopped happening? Airlines around the world stopped paying me for my aircraft and my jet engines because they couldn't afford to because they weren't flying. But my employees still came to work. My employees still came here. So when I look at what it is that is important in terms of the fuel that powers my organization, it's the people. not the assets that generate revenue, because when that stopped, it stopped. But my employees didn't. My employees have the capability of getting together. It's not about one, the brain power of, my brain power, the brain power of an individual. It's the brain power of the collective. You get together and say, guys, what ideas do you have? What can we do? What is it that we're not doing that we should be doing? How do we get things back on track? How do we generate revenue? Who do we call? And it's the collective brain power. It's the collective commitment to making the company profitable that made us get through the pandemic in a time where a lot of companies didn't make it. And even the companies that did laid off thousands and thousands or tens of thousands of people. I start to wonder how a CEO could look at his organization and say, we are so fat as an organization that we can do the same thing with 10,000 less people. How is that even possible? It's probably the most ludicrous thing. I get frustrated when I hear that a company is laying off 20,000 people. Well, then what are you shutting down? Because if you're going to do the same thing with 20,000 less people, there is something fundamentally wrong with your business plan or your management, because you have just totally overspent during good times. And we never do that. I said it earlier. Yeah. We operate like bankruptcy is tomorrow. We operate like every dollar counts. Our team, our culture is that way. We have a lot of fun, but at the same time, we're careful and we don't have to lay people off.
I love that. Operate like bankruptcy is tomorrow, right? I mean, it's such a great point.
Yeah, that's amazing. I did notice that in kind of preparing for this episode, I was like, oh, 900 million in revenue and 900 employees or thereabouts. And I was like, that's unique. I don't know if I've ever seen it. And then you share, $1 million.
That's our formula. That's our formula. You figure out how much revenue you should generate for every additional headcount, and it makes it easy. By the way, it's a way too simplistic way of doing it. I'm not saying it works for everyone, but for us, it's worked for 22 years and we still live by it. And we measure revenue by employee, gross profit by employee, net profit by employee. We manage, one of the things we do, we sell labor hours in our technical businesses. We manage productivity, what percentage of productivity that each of our mechanics or technicians has in a given day. We measure everything so that we know exactly where we are.
Yeah, to think that you've gone from about one employee per million when you started, but that first year at 7.5 million with 6 or 7 employees, right, to where you are today is incredible to stay at that pace, because you were very lean and mean. You guys were all ditch diggers in the beginning, so you've still kept that same type of work ethic, right? So, I mean, that's not common. People just constantly hire, thinking that's going to solve your problems. Boy, but if you can just hire well, you don't have to, you can stay at a, very lean pace like you have. It's really cool.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. Abdul, where can our audience find out more about you?
Well, www.gatelesis.com is the company's website. We have a ton of openings to facilitate our growth. So we're a global country. Our biggest operations are in the United States, primarily in South Florida, in the UK, and just outside of London, in Istanbul, Turkey, in Helsinki, Finland, and in China. So we have people all over the world. Outside of that, we have small regional offices on every continent, anywhere from 2 to 5 people that are there representing our needs with our customers' needs, on a day-to-day basis. So, we're growing and, it's all about the people for us. I always say, we don't sell a product. We sell access to our people. They are our number one resource and they are what we sell.
Amazing. Well, I tell you what, Abdul, we want to stay in touch. We really appreciate you. You're an amazing example of the American dream. And, you know, this is what we're about. I'm going to continue to find the best of the best in the country, like you, they're example of the American dream. And boy, not many people have done what you've done in this world. You know, this American dream is alive and thriving. We need to keep it that way.
Thank you.
And your story is one that's going to motivate many. So I really appreciate it. Thanks so much for being a Ditch Digger CEO today. And thank you, everybody, for listening to Ditch Digger CEO. Again, another example of why, you know, these rags to riches stories, you know, all the reasons why they work. And Abdul, you've really blessed us with your time today. I appreciate it. So
thanks, guys. Thank you.
So until next time, thanks for listening to Ditch Digger CEO. I really appreciate everybody being here.
See you. Bye.
If you enjoy this show, please share with anyone else you think will find value here. And please go to our website, ditchdiggerceo.com, for show notes, links, video clips, and more nuggets of entrepreneurial wisdom. Don't forget to follow me on social media at ditchdiggerceo. Not